Welcome to a brand new episode of the Cinema Stories Podcast. I'm Lights Camera Jackson. Hope you're doing well. Thank you for listening. The anticipation is building towards when we can return to indoor movie theaters, the indoor movie theater experience. We're waiting. We're hoping. All of us film critics, film enthusiasts, everybody who loves going to the movies. And so I'm doing this special podcast series to bring on film critic colleagues and friends to talk about the movie going experience, favorite stories of being in the theaters, and also our take on what's going on right now and what it could be like in the near future as far as going to the movies. My guest is a good friend of mine. She is currently the arts writer for the Albany Times Union, was a film critic and arts writer for the Times Union from 1991 to 2000, film critic for Shout Magazine 2001 to 2003. Her reviews were published in all the Hearst newspapers, including the Times Union, but also the Houston Chronicle, San Francisco Chronicle from 2004 to 2012, named Albany Author of the Year in 2004. I'm giving you a big intro here, Amy. I know.
Sorry. Yeah, thank you so much, Jackson. And wow, you've got quite the bio. Well, with me.
You won the Comment and Criticism Award from the Texas Associated Press Managing Editors Association in 2007. You were named an Albany Public Library Literary Legend in 2014. And one more, the 2019 New York Associated Press Award for your piece on meeting William Shatner. That is all the accolades I have. Now we can jump in. Amy Biancoli, how are you?
Oh, I'm doing very well, Jackson. I have to tell you that that Shatner piece, which I wrote after hosting that Proctor's event, the screening of Wrath of Khan, I actually turned to my colleagues and said, with absolutely no exaggeration, sarcasm whatsoever, this is the highlight of my career.
Over everything else.
Yes, it was absolutely the acme of everything that had ever happened to me professionally. But so.
Yeah, well, so glad that you're here on Cinema Stories. We're going to take a trip down memory lane. Amy and I have screened many movies together over the years, primarily from about 2008 to 2012. And we'll get into some of those years, some of those really fun years. I still look back on those as some of my favorite years of being in this biz. And we'll get into all of that in a little bit. But first of all, how are you? How's the family? And how have you been doing through all of this the past 3-4 months?
Oh, thank you for asking. I am counting my blessings. I have my health. My loved ones have their health. I still have my job. Yeah. I'm able to do it from home. These are strange times. These are monumental, historic times. Who knows what else 2020 is going to dish out, but this is quite a moment we're all in.
It is, it is. But have you been keeping yourself busy watching all kinds of movies and shows and some of the new ones the studios have been offering? Have you been taking advantage of VOD or streaming services?
I have to confess, I haven't really been watching too many movies, except for old ones, some old Gene Kelly movies. But I've been binging on various science fiction series, I have to confess, yes, because that's where my nerdishness kind of has asserted itself in these months. I'm just, you name it, I've binged on it.
Yeah, you are a diehard Trekkie and have been into that sci-fi world. I had Jim Dixon on the podcast a couple episodes ago. He's a good friend of ours. We went to many screenings together over the years, and he's been watching a lot of the classic movies as well and getting into some of that. And I'll bring up a little bit here a few stories involving Jim and the three of us and all of that. But first off, just so everybody can get to know you a little bit and all that, was it right away in 1991 when you were brought on to the Times Union? Right away that you started reviewing movies?
No, it was more gradual and kind of organic. I started freelancing for the Times Union in 91 as a local arts writer. I retroactively in 92 was made a staff writer. It was a guild action to make me a staffer, and then also Greg Hames at the same time. So I started out as a local arts critic, not a local arts writer. I did some criticism as well, including music, some concert reviews and stuff. But then I morphed gradually and kind of organically into the Times Union film critic. And in part because the longtime staffer who had been doing it left. Actually, he died of cancer, tragically. And then about a year after that, I don't remember what the first screening was, but I remember just getting an alert for it and turning to the arts editor at the time and saying, hey, how about, you know, I go to this screening, this local screening, and review it. And they said yes. And then I did more, and they said yes. And then I did more. And every time I asked, they said yes. And so I kind of morphed into the full-time film critic. And I greatly enjoyed it for the rest of the time. So it was probably, I think it must have been around 93, 94 that I started actually writing movie reviews for the TU.
So did you ever anticipate movie reviews in your life in your younger years before going to the TU, or did this really just sort of happen?
Well, no, I have to say that I did. This was something I always wanted to do. I mean, I was a movie buff from a very, very, very early age, and I had always been interested in arts and cultural reporting, and specifically movie criticism. And I wasn't sure how to go about it. So when I got the position, when I got the gig writing for the TU as a local arts writer and started doing, you know, cultural reporting and criticism in that capacity, then I thought, well, maybe this is an opportunity for me to start reviewing films as well. And it just happened. I suppose it was part of my evil plan, but...
And then
I'm allowed to have evil plans.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden, about 10 years later, I mean, your reviews are all over the country in so many newspapers all over the country. The first times when that happened, could you sort of believe it that you're going from one newspaper to tons?
Well, you know what's funny is that to me, it really didn't mark that much of a transition, because I started out at the Times Union seeing movies in Albany, writing my reviews from Albany, occasionally having to go down to New York City to go to a screening. And then when I started doing it for the Houston Chronicle, I first started writing reviews for them in 2004. And then eventually, a couple years later, they started running them throughout all person newspapers. Maybe it was the following year, I think. Anyway, it didn't really change much for me, because they didn't even ask me to move to Houston. I went out once for the interview and once to fill out, you know, human resources paperwork or something. And that was it. So I continued to see movies in Albany and write my reviews in Albany. And I, you know, and when I learned that they were actually going to be publishing them throughout Hearst newspapers, it was great. I mean, it was exciting. I was really happy about it, but it did not change my reality whatsoever. The only people I ever saw at screenings mostly were you, Jim Dixon, the late Dan DiNicola, occasionally Gene Shalit, you know, and that was it. Unless I went down to New York City, and then I'd go to these absolutely mobbed screenings, which were just a completely, I mean, you've been down there, it's just a completely different scene.
It is, because it's many more critics in New York City. Every seat is filled, and sometimes they even bring in the audiences. Yes, it is a definitely different vibe, yeah.
Yeah, very different. But I enjoyed being up in the hinterlands, because I felt like it, in a way, it made my perspective, made me adhere to my perspective a little more, obey it a little more, and not kind of feel as though I had to get a sense of the crowd, like the idea of a consensus. It's like I mean, we were always really careful not to even express opinions to one another.
Yes, yes. And sometimes when you and I and Jim, we did little web series, The Critics, for a little while, we would wait until some of those to talk about our opinions on certain films, or wait until, you know, the next screening after a certain movie to wait and share our thoughts. But it's interesting because in, you know, your time period was pre-Twitter explosion, Facebook explosion, and a lot of online critics being able to sort of review movies from anywhere and post anywhere. And you had that real experience, too, for the newspaper world. I mean, when my grandparents, and I've told you this, that my grandparents admired your work very much, and when they were reading your reviews in the TU, and it would still say Houston Chronicle, and then they were surprised when I would tell them, she lives around here. I go to these meetings with her. They thought you lived in Houston.
A lot of people thought I lived in Houston. I think it always shocked and maybe disappointed them a little bit to learn that I didn't live in Houston. But nothing against Houston. It's a fascinating city. But I enjoyed doing my little job from Albany.
Yeah, well, it was a little job, but a big impact in the world of film criticism. The first time I met you was, do you remember this?
I knew you were going to bring up this story.
Yes. Secret Life of Bees screening, 2008. Yep. It was about 5 weeks into me being on Capital News 9. I had just started at the TV station, and it was like 10 in the morning at Latham Circle Mall, which is no longer there, which is too bad because it had the best parking lot. And it was Secret Life of Bees. And you walked in on crutches, Amy.
Yeah. Yep, I did.
Was it a skiing accident or something? I'm trying to remember.
Yes. Yeah, well, no, I said yes, but I think about it. In my mind, it connects to skiing because my concern was that I wouldn't be able to ski that winter. But actually, no, I was... I had been out on the street, the dead end street in front of my house in Albany with my younger daughter, who was then, I'm not sure how old she was then. It would have been what, 2008 or something?
Yeah.
Probably. Yeah. Okay. So she was in high school and not even, she was in middle school then. And so I was kicking the soccer ball around with her and, I hadn't stretched beforehand, and I played soccer in high school and college, and this was the bane of my life. If I didn't stretch, I always pulled or popped muscles. So I popped a calf muscle and fell to the pavement and broke my fibula. So it was action-packed. Wow. And it was the main thing was all the swelling in my calf with all the bleeding, which meant I had to keep it up. So I remember going to screenings, bringing a little folding stool, and I would prop up... I'd prop up my foot and watch the movie. It was no big deal, but it was, you know, it made an impression on you, which is what counts.
And I remember you were there with one of your daughters, and then you said, you know, good luck to you. And then we reunited several months later at another screening, and one that stands out to me as I was thinking about all our different screenings over the years was Princess and the Frog. Now, this was the Disney animated film, 2009, December. It was a Saturday morning screening. Of course, they bring in lots of kids at the Saturday morning screenings. And I remember at the end of the movie, you leaned over to me and you said, "So what'd you think of that?" And I said, "It was okay." And you went, "Okay." And then you laughed.
Well, first of all, I don't remember this. I don't question it. Secondly, I'm a little disappointed in myself that I was asking you to give me your opinion of a movie before, you know, we had been able to go off and form our own alone, uninfluenced by one another. And thirdly, I have no idea what I meant.
I think you were just surprised.
I don't remember.
I think you were just surprised that I only thought the movie was okay, and I think you gave it a 4-star review, right? You loved it?
You know what? Here's the piece of the interview with you, the conversation in which I admit that I don't always remember the movies that I've reviewed, because I saw so many of them in such quick succession that I felt, this is the way I always describe it, I felt as though I had a shelf in my brain that accommodated 6, 7, 8 movies at a time. And as soon as one movie was placed on the shelf, at the other end, one fell off. And that was the only way I was able to maintain sanity, because I would not just see the movies that we reviewed, that I reviewed every week, not just those, but also I would do a lot of research and watch, you know, oh, I haven't seen that director's other films, so I would watch those films and then screenwriter's films. And so I would just be, and then catching up on other movies that I didn't review. So I wind up seeing just a crush of movies every week. So this is why I'm embarrassed to say I don't remember The Princess and the Frog, and even whether I liked it.
Wow. Interesting. Well, yes. I'm sure it's on Disney Plus now, or will be at some point if it's not. But yeah, interesting. Because yeah, you were reviewing tons of movies, and we're in this period now where so many critics are getting lots of screeners and links. I've been getting lots of screeners and links to new films being released on streaming and VOD. I watched a movie a night for 12 nights in a row in the past couple weeks. I mean, it is a lot. It is a lot to take in movies and then be able to write thoroughly about them or talk thoroughly about them, but you were able to do it. You pulled it off. You did.
I don't know if you say so.
Yeah. One of the other things I remember you telling me once, and I may have this wrong, but you can let me know, is that sometimes I'd be surprised when I'd see your review come out and I'd see you gave a movie 2 stars or 2.5 or something. I'd be a little surprised and be like, hey, how come you only gave it this or things like that? And you said to me once that you didn't always come up with the star ratings. Like, they were recommendations, and then the outlets could read your reviews and say, well, based on how I feel she thought about this movie, I'm going to put 3 stars down, when you really hoped it would be 3.5. Is that true?
You know, I'm trying to remember. I think initially when I started, well, definitely when I was at the Times Union, did we have star ratings? I don't think we did, at least not at first. Then when I started at the Houston Chronicle, initially, we did not have star ratings. We had, I'm trying to remember if it was like a grading system instead, like an alphabet system. I don't remember exactly. But what I do remember is that after it was instituted, the star rating was instituted, that there was, I think occasionally, yes, outlets would change the star ratings, or they would certainly assign them if I didn't have one already. But what frustrated me most is that, okay, say I would write a 2.5-star review, and the 2.5-star review, okay, that's not a rave, but to me that says, okay, this isn't a great film. It might have a lot of flaws, but if you read it, you'll see what I actually think about it, and maybe from what I say about it, you'll decide it's a movie for you. And I feel as though in this obsession we have with finding consensus among critics, you know, the tomato meter thing, and just the urge to simplify everything, I feel like a lot of nuance gets lost. And I would just feel like, oh God, you know, I have to assign a star rating to a movie review. That means that people are going to discount it one way or the other. And that always bothered me.
That's interesting. I remember Jim telling me once too, he never liked doing star ratings when he was writing for the Examiner website, because you want people to understand where you're coming from.
Yeah.
You know? And not just look at it and go, okay, it's so-so, or it's good, or is that. You want to be able to have them know, what are the good points? What are the strengths? What are the weaknesses? So I understand that completely. Amy Biancoli is my guest right now on the Cinema Stories podcast. Follow her on Twitter at Amy Biancoli. She's on Facebook as well, and the Times Union website with all the stories, all the articles. In 2011, from what I hear, because I was down in New York City covering the screening and premiere of Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2, but from emails that I remember getting that day, you had gotten the movie in like an hour's time. You called up me and Jim and said, can you get over to one of these theaters, because I got the new Harry Potter? And I guess Jim was part of it. Did that happen a lot, where you would get movies literally and say, all right, I got it, you know, we're going to show it in an hour?
Meaning get it like not on CD, but like a screening?
Right, to have a screening be at one of the theaters.
Yeah, I don't remember it being quite as sudden, with quite a quick pivot. I don't remember that. I do remember that happening, but that was unusual. I mean, it all depends. See, the thing is that I was always struck by this, and I'm sure I don't have to tell you this, that the ease of getting a screening, I mean, a press screening, because obviously there are these bigger screenings, these advanced screenings that where they pass out tickets to regular people, you know, regular moviegoers. But the ease of getting a press screening was just so closely related to how good a movie was and how motivated the powers that be were to get critics to see it. So it was usually a sign of the quality of a film and marketability of a film when the publicists were able to turn it around and get a screening quickly.
Yeah. I'm, you know, in trying to set up a lot of the private critic screenings these days, things have only changed a little bit in the sense that it's certain studios that want to show them in certain markets, and the movies don't necessarily have to be great. So I guess that's the part that's changed a little bit. But I can understand in your case them reaching out and saying, hey, you know, we think this movie is great. We want you to review it. But sometimes I remember you would come to screenings of movies that you weren't even assigned to review for the Houston Chronicle and the newspapers.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I went to lots of advanced screenings, regardless of whether I was assigned to review them or not. Yeah. I mean, how are they, do they occur as frequently any longer? I mean,
it's a little tougher these days. It is. Sometimes it is just me and Jim and Rick Marshall, who's going to be on the podcast here in an episode or two, and maybe one or two others in the rep, but it's sometimes the studios feel it costs too much money to only have even important critics like us in certain market and in all the markets around the country. It may just cost too much to do it. That's where I think it is. But you had such power during those years, especially the years I was with you at these screenings from 08 to 2012. You had a lot of power to make some of these screenings happen, which I truly appreciate. I mean, there were so many Saturday morning animated movie screenings that I thoroughly enjoyed, because I would go from the TV station to the screening. I would do trivia sometimes or giveaways and things. And you were at pretty much all of those, most of those.
Well, yeah. I mean, I love movies. I love going to movies. If a movie screens in the theater and it's free, I'll be there, you know? But it's funny that you say I had power. I thought of Dan, our late friend Dan, as having such influence, because he really was so known and admired in the community. And you know, maybe it's maybe after my reviews started going wide, Hearst newspapers around the country, it's possible that maybe I had a little more pull. But to me, I always felt like Dan was the big guns, you know.
Well, yeah, Dan DiNicola was on CBS 6, the affiliate here in Albany, and the Schenectady Gazette, right? The Daily Gazette as well.
Yep.
Yeah. I met him once. I met him at Planet 51. I think you were there too. Maybe you weren't. It was at the Wilton Mall.
Okay. Yeah.
On a Saturday morning. I believe that's the only time I met Dan, and that was the end of 2009. Yeah, and I think he passed a couple months after that.
I had forgotten that you had less of, I was thinking you had more overlap with him, but wow. Yeah, that's right, because he died in 2010 or early 2011, something like that. Okay. I think 2010, yeah.
Yeah. Huh. But wow. Yeah, I always said, because now, I mean, sometimes I've been able to get some screenings in the area here specifically for voting for the Critics Choice Awards. And I guess, you know, some of the studios do see the value in a Critics Choice and SAG Awards voter being in this market. And then to be able to bring on, you know, Jim, who does vote for Online Film Critics Society Awards and Rick, does some other things and do that. But yeah, sometimes it can be a little tougher these days. But yes, it's interesting.
You have the power now, Jackson. You have the power.
I do. Sometimes you really got to convince these studios. But something, yes, I see that a little bit. But it's interesting that you saw it in Dan, and I saw it in you, as far as all of that. And now, one thing I always thought was fascinating is that you took notes during these movies. Now, I rarely have. But I would always be amazed that you could see in the dark. For all the diehard movie fans and other listening to this right now, what is the secret to taking notes during a movie in the dark?
Okay, first of all, no, I couldn't see in the dark. I do not have any superpowers, not even that one. Secondly, okay, what I would do is I would take a reporter's notebook, you know, one of those skinny reporter's notebooks, and with my left thumb, I would slide it down the edge of the notebook, and then each time I wrote a line, I would bring the pen back. I would lower my left thumb and bring the pen in my right hand back to touch my thumb, so it was lower down on the notebook, and that way I wouldn't write over my own scratchy notes. So I would run my thumb down the page, take notes. Sometimes I wouldn't be able to read them afterward because I have really terrible handwriting, but I would be able to, I mean, like if it was a really great scene, like a line of dialogue that popped out or something, I would just throw down the details. Sometimes I wouldn't spend much time looking at the notes, but it always helped me to pay attention. And then, but the problem, comical bit, was that if it was a tearjerker, and I always credit tearjerkers, whether they're good or bad, if they'd be like a zero star movie, if it's jerking my tears, they come out. And I would of course wipe my face, and then, you know, we'd come out of the theater and I'd chat with people or whatever, and then I'd go into the ladies' room and look in the mirror and realize that I had ink streaked all over my face.
But you were doing your job, so it was okay.
Yeah, that battle scars, right?
Yeah, it's okay. Yeah, no, I'm amazed. I don't know if I could do it. I don't know. When I get back to a theater, soon, hopefully, maybe I will try it just for your sake, and I'll let you know how I do.
There you go. And make sure you weep.
Yes, you know? I will cry. Whatever the first, if it's Tenant, hey, I'm gonna cry. Just that the movie is finally here, I'm gonna cry.
Tears of joy.
Tears of joy. Yes, tears of joy. That makes sense. I think it's okay that we can share this, since you are, you know, it's been years since the end of 2011, when I just got inducted into the Critics' Choice Association, but needed to wait until the next year to get into the award season. But we were starting up doing these critics webisodes, and you were so kind and gracious in lending me and asking the studio to lend to me your screener of The Artist so that I could see it in time. I will always thank you for that and appreciate that, because it's tough. I mean,
of course,
you know, lending each other screeners and things, and digital links, it's a little different now. It's in some cases a little looser, some cases not, but I thank you for doing that. That was rare, right? I mean, that was something you would, I mean, critics wouldn't normally do that at that time, but I so appreciate that you felt you wanted to do that.
Oh, but to me, it was not a big deal. I think the main reason we didn't really do it that much was because, I don't know, the studio always made such a huge deal about not sharing it. But beyond that, I think most of the time we had similar access. I mean, I actually remember one of the last times I saw Dan DiNicola, I can't remember what the film was, but I needed to borrow his copy of something, and I went up to his place in Saratoga Springs, and he lent it to me. So it does happen. It's not that rare. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not that common, but I was happy to do it.
Yeah, because it ended up being all three of us chose it as the number one movie of 2011. Of course, it went on to win everything pretty much that year. And it's funny, I remember we were starting to do these, to me, a little before its time, these critics episodes, and they're still on YouTube, and anybody can find them and check them out. But, I mean, you were kind of nervous to
yes,
be filmed. But now I see you doing, you know, all kinds of interviews and things, and you're really comfortable with it. So I'm so glad that I was able to help this part of your career through starting to do these.
Well, thank you. I I'm always happy to talk. I'm always a little nervous about being on camera, because that's one thing print journalists are not normally accustomed to, or not in previous ages. So we're all forced to get more at ease with it.
Yeah. But it worked. I remember I had gotten a screening of Journey to the Mysterious Island, because Warner Brothers wanted me to see it. That was in early 2012. And they wanted me to interview Vanessa Hudgens, which actually never happened, but that's okay because I still got to see the movie early. So I remember emailing you and Jim, and he was able to come, but you didn't because I think they sent you to New York City for that. I mean, how often would you be sent down to New York City to see one of these movies as opposed to it being brought to you here in Albany?
They usually happen once a month on average, sometimes a couple times a month, sometimes every other month. But yeah, usually once a month. I didn't mind it. I'm like, you know, I'd take the train down and back. And it was always interesting, as I said, you know, to go see it with a mob of journalists and some New York City crowd. And it was always fascinating to me because then I would see the critics come out and discuss the movie afterward. And I was like, what? No, don't do that. Don't. But I always enjoyed going down.
Yeah. You know,
those were fun days.
Yeah. We don't want to influence each other. We don't. We can debate it after the fact, but we don't want to influence each other. But what honestly did you prefer? Do you prefer going to the movies even now in your post-critic years, but still as the arts writer at the TU? Do you prefer it being a showing of a movie where it's you and just a few other people, or do you enjoy the audiences and those audience screenings that you were a part of?
Oh, well, I mean, I always preferred seeing it in a crowd. I just think it's such a communal undertaking. It's something that we all enjoy and we feed off each other and we laugh. Our laughter infects and affects one another. And, you know, I think it's just more moving. And no pun intended, to go to the movies in a crowd of people.
Interesting. You do have an infectious laugh. We have talked about this before. I remember you laughing very hard at the campaign, the Will Ferrell comedy, and
oh yeah,
some of those other movies over the years. But that's interesting. I mean, I enjoyed those screenings where it was just, you know, just a couple of us, because there was that intimacy and that ability to see a movie early and kind of.
Yes.
You know, be one of the few and to then say to everybody, hey, we got to see this. We want you to see this, or we don't.
No, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And I do not disagree with you. I loved seeing those movies with you guys. I really treasured that. And the, there was a sense of fraternity, sorority, whatever the gender neutral word would be. But comedy, I suppose, maybe it comes closer, but I really enjoyed seeing those films with you guys. And I also really enjoyed thinking hard about movies. And now I don't enjoy films less, but, and I still think about them pretty hard just out of habit, but I appreciated the chance to really dig down into why I liked a film, why I didn't like it, and get into the nitty gritty, make me think really deeply about a film. I do miss that.
Your reviews are still, many of them are still published online. Everybody can check them out. But yeah, you've noticed that in, because we've run into each other a few times over the years at the cinemas since the end of 2012. You've noticed, I mean, have you been tempted really on certain occasions to be like, gee, I wish I could really write about this movie right now?
Oh, sure. And I will occasionally write reviews of films with local connections, films that are shot locally or done by local filmmakers. But it's rare, and it's all in the context of my local arts beat. Yeah, I mean, and I really enjoy what I'm doing now, too. I loved writing movie reviews. I didn't want to stop doing it. I only stopped doing it because I was laid off. It was right after a year after my husband died. And so I miraculously bounced back into basically my old beat, the TU, my original beat, local arts. And it was a godsend. And I enjoy that too.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm just still getting paid to learn. In the past, I was paid to go see movies, but that was also part of getting paid to learn. And I'm still being paid to ask questions and be curious and to absorb things outside of my own perspective.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm so glad that you were able to get the old job back, basically, for the Times Union to allow you to come back home. I mean, not a lot of people get that opportunity. And I was so glad that only a month after you unfortunately got laid off at the end of 2012, that was able to happen for you. I was thrilled.
It was miraculous. I mean, it just happened that that position opened up. They didn't create the position for me. It literally just opened up. And I was blown away and very happy to go back to my old digs on Wolf Road in the newsroom.
Yeah. Timing is everything. And it was able to work out for you, which is so great. I remember one of the movies a couple years after you stopped writing reviews, but I got an email from you that said, "Hey, I got Foxcatcher," because you were doing a story. So there was a local tie-in to the movie Foxcatcher with Steve Carell and Channing Tatum and Mark Ruffalo. And I had emailed you back that I had already seen it at the Film Columbia Festival, but I was so glad that studio, Sony Classics, had set up a movie screening for you. And it was just like old times. Do you remember that day specifically, and being 2 years after the end of your film critic run, and kind of being like, whoa, this is deja vu?
Just like old times. Yeah, that was fun, you know. it's funny because I find that now when I watch films, like I definitely am not able to get out to the movies as much. Well, certainly not lately, but right. You know, I'm paid to do other things all day long, so that's part of it. But what's interesting to me too is that I find that I give less than good movies more of a pass now. And then part, that's what I mentioned before, is I'm not thinking necessarily as deeply as critically about them. But in part, it's that I have totally relaxed in many ways into simply being a viewer. And when I do have to review something, whether it's a local web series, a local film or something, then I find myself going into critic mode again. But and I also find myself going into critic mode when I see a really brilliant film, and I'll like tick off the reasons why it's brilliant to myself, if not to other people. But mostly I'm just back to where I was before I became a film critic, which is just a very, very happy moviegoer. And although lately I have not been watching a lot of new films on streaming services, I do feel as though a lot of the new shows that are running episodically now are essentially long films. And so that's been fascinating too.
Yeah. Yeah. The feature film quality has gone into television and it has exploded in that sense in the last 7-8 years. I agree with you completely on that. And you're right about this sort of critic mode. And I don't know if a lot of people totally understand. I mean, there is this mindset you have to get in when you're watching a film and when you have to write a review because it is your job and you need to have it be printed in the paper or be on TV or radio or whatever it may be. And that it's tough, even for me, when I know going in, I'm not even going to, you know, do a full review of this new movie I just happen to be seeing. But I still have that mode in my head, and I don't know if it will ever go away. I don't know.
Well, if you took a lengthy break from it, it would relax a little bit. It definitely would. Not that you'd want it to, but it's definitely interesting.
When you're looking at award season and all of that, and I still have that mindset too, does that change for you as far as sitting, watching the Oscars every year, rooting for films, rooting for performances, a little different than it was in the past?
Well, it's a little different because I'm not keeping up with everything in the course of a year, but I do try to see everything, at least the Best Picture nominees, before the Oscars. I don't always manage to, but I try. And then I get invested, you know?
Yeah.
I just get invested. And I'm sorry, Spider-Man Into the Spideyverse should have won. I mean, that just...
wait. So it was nominated for animated feature, not this past award season, the one before, or one animated feature.
But should have won Best Picture.
It should have not only been nominated for Best Picture.
Nominated, but won. Yeah. Yeah.
Really?
That was the best film I saw that year, I think.
Wow.
Definitely up there. Yeah.
I mean, I've wanted to see an animated movie win Best Picture. Toy Story 3 could have done it.
Yeah. Could have, yeah.
Up could have even done it. Beauty and the Beast, my all-time favorite movie, could have done it back in 92. But see, I'm not a... I love Sony Animation. The folks over there are fantastic. Mm-hmm. I'm glad they got an Oscar win for it finally, and the Hair Love Short this year getting them a win. Spider-Verse is not one of my favorite Sony animated films. It just...
Oh, gosh. I love that movie. I love that. But you and I didn't always agree on films, and that's fine.
Right. Yeah. Yes. But I remember now thinking back on when Amazing Spider-Man came out, and I think you liked the first Amazing Spider-Man, which I didn't, and I liked the second one.
You know, I actually don't remember that. And this is where Google comes in, because people will come over to me and say, "Oh, Amy, I remember you reviewed X." I'm like, I did. And then I consult the Oracle of Google. I'm like, "Oh yeah, I really liked that movie."
But you loved Spider-Man, but you thought it just exceeded your expectations and just blew you away.
Yeah, yeah. I just love the characterization of Spider-Man himself. It was terrific, and I loved its portrayal of different characters of color in a way that was just so perfect and energetic, and it was just... I get tired of superhero movies. I enjoy them, but I get tired of them. And that movie, I felt, not only told the Spider-Man story in a different way, but it took it in a different direction in terms of what story gets told, how the story gets told, who are the characters peopling the story that gets told, in a way that felt fun and culturally relevant and just so human.
Mm. It has had an impact on so many. There's going to be a second one, maybe a couple years away. We'll see if the delays keep going, but I know Sony is working on Spider-Verse 2.
Cool.
Yes. So you're into it. You're ready for another, because some people just want fantastic films, whatever they may be, to be left alone, to just be the one installment and be done. But you're okay with number two.
Yeah, I mean, it's an industry. Of course they're going to make a sale. they want to sell tickets. I get as frustrated with Hollywood as the next person for being so fixated on revenues. But on the other hand, it is a business.
Right.
So, we'll see. If it stinks, I'll be angry. But if it's good, I'll be happy.
Because it's funny, when it was 2012 when that first Amazing Spider-Man, also the Avengers movie came out, Dark Knight Rises, the superhero movie phenomenon was just kind of getting underway. And now, in your years since, it has, I mean, every other week for a long time before this shutdown, it was a superhero movie in some way.
Right.
And it is a lot. It has been overwhelming. I can attest to that. It has been overwhelming. One of the other things I want to ask you about here on this Cinema Stories podcast, obviously we've told a lot of stories, and the cinema part of it, you know, we in the Capital Region in upstate New York, in my lifetime especially, have seen a lot of movie theaters open, be redone, close. What stood out to you and what has stood out to you over the last 10, 15 years as far as the theaters themselves, the certain ones, whether it was Colony being built or Clifton Park being redone or some of the other ones, what has stood out to you from a theater perspective, and Latham closing, which was a huge deal at the time too?
Yeah. I think in general, what's changed is the experience being offered. Which is, I actually, one of the strip mall, old strip mall complexes that I like to go to see movies is the one in East Greenbush. And I like it because it reminds me of the old strip mall multiplexes that I went to as a kid growing up in Connecticut in the 70s. It's like huge theaters, tons of seats. You know, you walk in and yes, you've got concessions and everything, but basically the idea is you just go into a huge theater and maybe it's full, maybe it's half empty, but it used to be more of not bare bones, but it kind of got away from kind of the original concept of movie theaters, movie palaces being a full experience. And now it seems gradually we've started seeing more multiplexes in malls go toward higher end experiences. I don't know if that's really the way to describe it, but you know, the comfier seats, the reclining seats, the seats being farther apart, the stadium seating rather than kind of the gradual grade they used to see. And I understand it, and I understand that it's also the same reason that concession prices have gone way up, because if they're selling tickets, they've also got to sell concessions on top of it. But it's interesting to me, because going to the movies has always felt like the most democratic thing we all do, not just as Americans, but just as human beings in terms of art experiences. We all go to the movies together. Movies are inexpensive enough that most of us can manage to see a movie, if not every week, at least once a month, mostly. But they've gotten more expensive, and I understand why. And I think there's more of a push toward giving it that kind of higher, comfier experience. And I understand it, but I don't need it, I guess is what I'm saying. I'd rather just go into a big theater and kick back and not worry about whether my seat can recline and maybe pay a little bit less.
Interesting, because you would think, a lot of people would think, oh, the film critic needs the best premium experience possible when sitting and being able to watch the movie and the best quality.
Nah.
You know, I mean, the East Greenbush Theater, by the way, not that far from where I live, and it is a different vibe because it's not stadium seated, and it's one of the only Regal cinemas that I'm aware of, at least in our market, that is a standalone. It is not attached to a mall. It is not inside a mall. It is on its own. They stuck a restaurant next to it a couple years ago, but it is on its own. It is separate from everything else. A lot of times I go there just based on convenience, but also, yeah, I don't mind it. I don't mind sitting kind of towards the side sometimes, but sometimes I do hope that when it's certain movies, I don't know, I can be up a little bit in the stadium seating. I can be at eye level. But what's interesting is that at the critic screenings and at the audience screenings, they would put us kind of towards the bottom if we were at one of the multiplexes, in like the bottom first row, and we sort of look up a little bit at the screen. And sometimes I would like that, and sometimes I wouldn't, because you're at kind of a funky angle. But I guess you can adjust to anything.
Yeah, I'm just happy watching movies. And I tend to, if a movie's really good, aside from having the audience reactions around me, I tend to lose my sense of place. I mean, does that sound too extreme? I mean, I don't really...
No.
I don't associate, my love of film is not closely linked to where I'm sitting and how. I really, if a film is a great film and it sucks me in, so long as I'm not sitting on broken glass, I'm fine.
Huh. Wow. That's best. I didn't expect you to say all that, but I get the whole immersive part of it. I mean, we want movies to be immersive, where we're in them completely, we're with the characters, we are crying with the characters. We want that to happen, and it has happened to me on several occasions, and I'm glad that it has happened to you, and maybe it has happened to us while we've been just a few seats apart in the cinema over the years. Listen, Amy, I am so glad that you were able to share your film criticism with the world for more than two decades through the Hearst newspapers and the Times Union, and your film criticism through there, and Shout Magazine as well, and everything that you did with that. And I'm so glad that you're still making it happen as the arts writer and entertainment reporter over at the Times Union, getting to interview idols like William Shatner, which I remember in emailing with you leading up to that and after that, just how excited you were for that to happen. I mean, I've been fortunate to have met Roger Ebert and Regis Philbin, to get to know him as well, and to meet my idols. And for you, I could tell this was such a joyful experience for you.
Oh, completely. I'm such a nerd. I mean, it really was. It was just completely geeking out, you know, but I don't, I can own up to that because I really, if I ever care that other people looked at me as a nerd, I don't think I ever did, but I certainly don't now. I'm, you know, pushing 57 and hey, nerd and proud.
And winning awards for those guys. I mean, you know, if you do what you love and then you get awards for it, that's the little cherry on top.
That's right. Well, I'm very grateful.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm so grateful for our friendship. And, you know, honestly, I started out at that TV station at Capital News 9, became YNN, now the Time Warner, whatever name it's called now, at the Time Warner TV station. It's had like five names. But I started out on there at the age of 10, and there were a lot of people who said, what in the world is a 10-year-old on TV reviewing movies? And I was so grateful and still, and so thankful for you to accept a 10-year-old kid who was so interested and knows about movies and wants to learn more about movies and share his thoughts on movies, for you to accept me in the film criticism screenings world right away. I'm forever grateful for that. So thank you. Seriously.
Well, I'm grateful for your friendship and our years as colleagues. And it wouldn't have even occurred to me not to welcome you as a colleague. I mean, we're all kids. I mean, especially when we're passionate about something. And I hope never to lose that sense of childish passion, frankly. And so if you were already such a professional, I mean, you were a kid, but you were so driven, so passionate is the word. You were passionate about film and that came through, and it was wonderful attending screenings with you and calling you colleague as well as friend.
Thank you, Amy. I so appreciate that. And again, Amy Biancoli on Twitter at Amy Biancoli and on the Times Union website as well for all those articles. Yeah, those years being on TV and going to all those screenings and getting to do those critics webisodes, I so appreciate your friendship, and I so appreciate you being on this episode of Cinema Stories today, because your insights on the past, the present, and the future of the movie-going experience are so valuable and so cool and so interesting. So thank you so much for being on the show today, and all the best to you and your family.
Thank you, Jackson. Thank you for inviting me, and all the best to you and your family as well.
You're welcome. I'm Lights, Camera, Jackson. More episodes of the Cinema Stories podcast, this special summer event podcast series, are on the way, so stay tuned for those. And for more, go to lights-camera-jackson.com. Follow me on Twitter at LCJReviews and Instagram at LightscamJackson. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Cinema Stories podcast. We will see you next time.